Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. Hope you guys are doing great. Today we have a unique show and I'll tell you why. Our guest today is not only involved in commercial real estate, which we're going to talk about a lot, but he is involved in philanthropy in a way that I think that you guys will find it very interesting. And we're going to dig into it. We'll go right away. Michael Altman, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
And I really look forward for our conversation today. You know what? Before we even start digging into your story, give us like a 2-minute elevator pitch about what you're about in real estate, your passions. Go ahead.
All right. So in 2008, well, prior to 2008, I owned a commercial mortgage lending company. Prior to that, when I got out of business school, I was a bond analyst and a bond trader. But in 2008, when Lehman failed, my company was no longer viable. And my wife was in a hard money residential construction lending company, and that was no longer viable. We opened up Hallmark Abstract Service together because, you know, we recognized the need for solid title work. And we also recognized the fact that in that day, a lot of people were leaving the industry. So we started. What we focus on is both commercial and residential real estate. We're focused on New York State. We have a lot of people think that title insurance is a commodity product. We don't feel that way. And we have a few ways that we feel like we differentiate from the competitors. And that's pretty much the story. 3 great kids, all grown, all out of the house. And as you mentioned, I'm the board chair of a combat veterans charity that has a significant Israel component.
You know what? That was like a good briefing. I want to dig into your story a little bit. Let's go back in time a little bit and tell us how you got into real estate in the first place. What got you excited about this? How'd you get into this?
Okay. So actually, it goes back to 1987. When I spec built some houses out on Long Island. I don't know what you remember about 1987. You're a young man, so you probably weren't even born yet.
No, no, but, I was. I'm 73. I was born in 73, so I remember 87 pretty well. As a kid, you know, as an eighth grader, I think I was in eighth grade. Yeah, but I remember it.
Well, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, I got married the week after the market crashed. So. What my wife used to say was that the people who got married the week before probably got bigger checks, but that our checks probably didn't bounce. So that was a good thing. But so in 1987, I got involved in real estate. It was phenomenal. You know, I had a real love for the whole process. Unfortunately, 1987 wasn't the best time to be trying to sell houses. And you know, that was a rough time. I spec built probably 8 houses, and definitely was an experience, not the greatest of experiences, but a great learning platform. And then, you know, as I said, I was a trader, I was an analyst, and then I had an opportunity in about 2000 to get involved in commercial real estate. and opened a small balance commercial mortgage lending company, which at the time was terrific because we focused on loans $1 million and under, and primarily for borrowers who had a little deals with a little bit of hair on them, not the kind of guys who could go directly to a money center bank, but guys who needed help, who needed a story to be told, you know. And in commercial real estate, I always used to say, two guys can bring the same deal to the same underwriter, and one guy's going to get a yes and one guy's going to get a no based on how they feel you, what you know about the industry. And actually, funny story at the time, not that funny, but I had a two CD program created that I actually was selling on Amazon that was how to underwrite a commercial mortgage loan. It was an interesting time, but you know, as you know, when 2006 and on hit, it became a rough time, without question. And that was kind of my metamorphosis. You know, I have a diverse background, finance, and actually my background was in municipal bonds and housing bonds. So the importance of title insurance was always very clear. And for my wife in the hard money residential construction lending, where the property is your collateral, there's really no more important thing than making sure that you have good, clean, clear title to that property. And actually, her loans were considered commercial loans.
Tell me something.
Sure.
You know, talking about this whole experience, it's a very serious experience. And many of the people, you know, that are listening could definitely identify with that. And some of them are, I guess, young and are excited about hearing about this from someone who actually went through this. But I'm interested in really, and this is really exciting, to understand a person who got into a mortgage, you know, a commercial mortgages, and to try to understand it, you know, as a broker or as a guy who underwrites deals at that right. time, which is by far a lot different than underwriting today, for sure. Can you tell us a little bit about how different it was than what it is today? And what did you feel sure. from helping all those people? Where, you know, were they subprime or not? You know, tell us a little bit about that experience with dealing with, you know, the banks and the, you know, and the and the financial, you know, institutions.
Absolutely. So my bank that I wrote loans through, you know, that I was correspondent lender for, they were not subprime. But at the time, there were definitely subprime lenders there were two very large ones, Silver Hill. I don't know if you remember them. And another one who they would go down to FICO scores 500. I mean, they were lenders who were looking for a problem, much like a lot of the lenders on the residential side at the same time. But there were loans that could be underwritten at a variety of different types of lenders, like even Lehman, before they went under, you know, they had a lending program. It wasn't subprime per se, but, you know, they would look at 600 FICO scores, 650 FICO scores. But, you know, the fact that for loans that, you know, had a debt service coverage ratio of 1.3 or maybe 1.4, to be taking investors with 500 credit scores was really a problem waiting to happen. And so at the time, you know, we didn't broker all our loans. We brokered some of the loans, but you know, it was a very interesting group of clientele who for the most part had a lot of hair on their deals. But I actually started my company. It was my company, but I worked with a guy who he was the underwriter of our loans. He was very experienced in underwriting, and he was able to. Together, we helped a lot of people get funded who normally would never have gotten funded. And it was the same in my wife's company. You know, they were basically writing commercial loans, but they really didn't care what your financial makeup looked like, as long as you owned the property free and clear. And, you know, they did numbers, they crunched numbers on what it was you wanted to build, what the finish value would be, what the takeout mortgage would look like. But as far as your personal financial standing, it didn't matter. And again, it didn't matter, which was fine, until it mattered, which was in 2008. And, you know, it was the old story of, you don't want to be the last one standing when the music stops.
Exactly. You know, I'm talking about this whole thing, and your experiences really correlate between, and I think you're the first one I'm talking to who had the, I would say, the experience with the actual loans on one hand, and then with the bonds. I'm assuming MBS, CMBS, I don't know exactly, but I would love to understand from you exactly the, you know, your move from one thing to another, and your understanding of, you know, obviously dealing with Lehman, or not with Lehman, but understanding with dealing with that business and seeing Lehman go, you know, go down, and almost the others pretty much go down, almost. Right. And finally, they were saved, I guess. And our economy were pretty much, was pretty much saved, but crashed. And yes, then everybody had to go back into, you know, we had to go back into reality.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, your knowledge about MBS, CMBS, and what you've, you know, what you saw at the time.
Well, I experienced. So I think what you learned was, again, you know, to take it from a, from the residential hard money construction lending to the bigger picture, is that nothing is a problem until it becomes a problem. You know, a client, a builder, is a great builder until something comes up and he has to start using money from this loan to pay vendors for another property. And, you know, I think what it shows you is that lax standards, whatever that is, in whatever business, are really temporary in terms of their ability to last. You know, nothing is forever. And, you know, you can paper over lax underwriting standards, or really lax anything that you do, and it's fine until, as I said, until it's not. And, you know, what I learned, so from the bond business, you know, what I learned was that they would sell bond insurance. There were two major companies, MBIA and AMBAC. And, you know, they would take on probably, their leverage was probably 50-1 in terms of capital to the amount of deals they would underwrite, that they would insure. And, you know, and again, another recipe for disaster, you know, AAA
bonds. Yes, it is.
So in 2008, those AAA bonds were now uninsured because those companies went under. And what it showed, so my wife and I, we started this company in 2008. And we always believe in the lean and mean focus. You know, we don't, you know, title companies have a certain reputation as big spenders and freewheeling, although in 2008 that changed a little bit. And we also became, the regulation became much tighter. But, you know, we believe in doing business within our means and living within our means. And I think that's, and doing business conservatively. You know, we don't look to kill deals, but if there's an issue with a deal, we don't paper it over. You know, we will address.
You're not gonna pursue.
Yeah, definitely.
Tell me something. The movement from bonds to mortgage brokering to title. Tell us a little bit about that movement and how, meaning I understand from everything you say, I see how naturally it was for you to move towards that way. I could tell. But if you could explain a little more what you guys had to go through in terms of your know-how, you obviously knew underwriting, but title insurance, it's, you know, there's the legal aspect of it. What did you guys have to go through in order to start that business and to go towards that?
Well, to tell you the truth, so because title was critical in both of our prior businesses, you know, I knew about title from bonds because I was involved in housing bonds. You know, the transition wasn't that huge, although we had looked into title insurance prior to starting our company. We had, there's a company on Long Island called Equity Settlement. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but a couple of guys from there approached us prior to starting our company and asked us if we'd be interested in originating title deals, and then they would do the back office work. So we had looked into it, and we knew quite a bit about it. You know, we knew quite a bit from our prior experience in business, and we knew quite a bit about it from talking to these guys about the potential for doing the concept that they brought up. We also had the opportunity. So there was a woman who is our chief title officer now and has been since the beginning, who was working for a company that she didn't really like the way that they did business. So she was unhappy. She was looking for a change, and we hired her. You know, in 2008, when both our businesses were no longer viable, we had two girls in college. We had a son who was on his way to college, and we lost a lot of our money in 2008. So we needed to reinvent very quickly. And our chief title officer was available. We hired her, and we started on our way. So it really was a natural progression. You know, there were certain barriers to entry at the time. The most key, well, I guess the largest one, getting clients. But the second largest one was getting an underwriter. And at the time, the large underwriters, the Fidelities, the First Americans, the Stewarts, they weren't bringing on new companies. They were getting rid of old companies. You know, they had a lot of problems at the time. So we ended up getting on with some of the smaller ones, and we had to earn our chops to finally get on with the larger ones. You know, and there was a catch 22 at the time, because a lot of attorneys don't want to use less than the top underwriters. So a catch 22 of, we don't have a top underwriter. How are we going to generate the business we need to get with the top underwriter? And it was a process. But probably about 4 years in, we started in 2008, and we got on with Fidelity, which is the largest and best capitalized underwriter there is. So,
that's right.
You know, like everything else we do, it's hustle. It's just, you know, never say never, never say die, and you got to keep moving forward. You know what I tell my kids all the time? You know, you can look back, but when you have a problem, you have to look forward and look for a solution. You know, there's always going to be a solution. You just have to be willing and focused enough to look for it.
You guys made a major change. Obviously, it was natural in a way, but you did it, meaning, and you took whatever resources you had and you got into this. But tell us a little bit about what is the company, where is the company today?
In terms of what we do, our size?
Yeah, the size, your team, your meaning, everything, your activity, all around. Would love to hear about it.
Again, we stay lean and mean. So in terms of full-time employees, you know, we're in like the 4 to 5 range. We have probably 6 salespeople who are W-2, but they are commission only. We have grown to the point where we're probably one of Fidelity's stronger mid-size companies. I think last year we probably did in the range of like 60 closings a month, which to some companies is a pittance and to other companies is a lot. But I think it puts us, as they used to say, as George said on Seinfeld, right in the sweet spot of the curve.
I like that. I want to go to another thing that you do, a passion of yours. Tell us a little bit about the Heroes Program for veterans. And I looked at the website right before we started speaking, and obviously I found so many things that I could relate to as a person who also served the Israeli Army. So tell us a little bit about this. How you got into it in the first place?
Absolutely. So I was in Manhattan. I was at a business club where, you know, you go, you do work, you get coffee. I love coffee. And I was sitting at a table. There was a woman sitting across from me doing work on her computer. I asked her what she was doing, and she described this foundation that she started out of love and passion. And after she got done explaining it, I said, you know, I want to get involved with that. So it started slow. You know, I started by going to their golf outing to check it out. And then I joined the board, and then I became the board chair. And, you know, basically, so if you listen to the mission, and I know that, you know, given where you are, you can appreciate the mission. So it's a non-denominational combat veteran 501c3 called Heroes to Heroes Foundation. And our basic mission is working with combat vets who come home from war suffering with moral injury. And I don't know, are you familiar with moral injury?
Not really.
So what basically, it's when you do something that's so abhorrent, so against everything that rational human beings think is the right thing to do, that you can't live with yourself. You know, you internalize it most of the time. So, you know, as an example, we had one, and again, most of our guys are not Jewish, probably 99%, but they still go to Yad Vashem, they go to the Western Wall, and they also get baptized in the Jordan River. But we had a guy who really didn't want to go. His family forced him to go. They drove him to New York and put him on the plane. And he wasn't really communicating. And when he got out of Yad Vashem, he called everyone together. And he said, I have a story I want to tell. And the story he told was he was out with his platoon, and a father and his son approached them. The father gave his son his gun and said, kill the infidels. So this guy, who has children at home, had to kill the 10-year-old boy. And then the father, basically forgiving the gun to the 10-year-old boy. But it's the first time he had really ever told that story. And it had been eating him up alive inside. So our mission is based in peer support, spirituality, and reconnection to faith. And loss of faith is a large factor in a great percentage of suicides. So we send teams of 12 to Israel, where there's no more spiritual place on earth. And they travel for 10 days, and they travel with three IDF soldiers who are in many cases suffering in much the same way. And it's not a vacation. They travel during the day, and at night they have group meetings without Judy, the founder, who I met that day. She doesn't participate in those meetings. And these guys, basically, they bond, and they vent what's been inside of them for years. You know, a lot of these guys have bad marriages or have had a divorce, don't have relationships with their kids because, you know, they're basically living with rage, despair, loneliness. And
they went through a lot.
They've gone through a lot, more than someone like me who didn't serve could imagine. And, you know, we've sent 29 teams. Our next team goes, I believe, in September. And, you know, we have no deaths. Every one of our veterans is alive and with us. And, you know, a lot of them have traumatic brain injury, but they're living their best lives to the extent that they can. And we've saved marriages, we've saved relationships with children. And it's just, it's been a phenomenal experience for me. You know,
this is a phenomenal program. And the fact, meaning I'm amazed, the fact that you got involved, obviously, meaning no one could look at it and say, oh, this is not meaningful. Of course, it's meaningful. Everybody could relate to it. It's great. But to get really involved in it as a person who did not, meaning who was not a veteran, and say, I want to be a part of it, I think it's phenomenal. What got you to get so drawn into it? Meaning, what was the trigger? And also, I want to hear what got this lady, Judy, who I'm assuming started this, yes, to start this whole thing. I would love to understand.
Well, I've always had a love for the military. And, you know, I grew up, my brother was in the last, you're familiar with lottery for the Vietnam draft?
No, tell me about it.
Every year they used to draw balls out of a wherever, out of a machine, I guess like a bingo machine, and each ball would have a birthday on it. And the birthday, the number your ball was drawn, was that determined how close you were to being drafted. If you were the number one ball being chosen, you were going. And, you know, you talk about stress if you didn't want to serve. You know, and you're waiting to see what number your ball was picked. But my brother was in the last year that the lottery took place. But I've always been very attuned to what these guys do who allow me to live the life that I live, you know, to live in freedom, to live in, you know, the best, one of the best countries on earth.
Absolutely. And,
you know, when she told me about what she does to support these guys, you know, I think there's also a shortfall in terms of, you know, you see the commercials for Wounded Warrior Project. They do great work. You know, guys with physical injuries, guys with hidden injuries don't necessarily get the attention. A lot of could be because people don't know, you know,
they look normal. It's normal. Israel, they're, we have the same problem, right?
Yeah,
there's the same problem in Israel. In America, the problem exists. In Israel, the problem exists. But I'm sorry I'm stopping you, but I think that it's also phenomenal that you guys chose Israel to be that place to do it and do it with IDF soldiers. And the reason I think it's phenomenal is because in Israel, everybody has to go to the army eventually.
Right.
So most civilians, not everybody, but most civilians do go to the army and get drafted. I myself was an infantry soldier. I did not get, meaning I was not there for a very long time because I got an injury, a shoulder injury, and they kicked me out. So I'd never had the privilege or the, you know, the luck to be in a combat or anything like that. But you know what? Everybody around me was in a combat, meaning my brother suffered from it.
Really?
Heavily.
He has issues that he doesn't articulate or does.
So with my brother, I'll give you an example, and he's usually not listening to my show, so I feel comfortable talking about this, and I love him dearly. He's younger than me. He went through the army and was in pretty much the same unit that I was, but in his case, he was a little longer, and he happened to be in, you know, in a place that was in a combat. And he experienced, not up front, he was not in the combat. He was actually behind the radio at the time. And his friends who were at the combat suffered majorly, and many of them died. And he heard the whole thing in the radio. So you could imagine what it did to that kind of a kid. And when you're crazy. And for years, and there was a fire. It was a very famous story in Israel. There was a fire during the combat, and they all burned, meaning many of them were burned. It was horrific. And he had to go and identify them. So this was, and I remember that he came home and he just did not speak. And for years, we asked him what's going on. He did not speak. He just couldn't speak for years and years and years. And then finally, when I actually lived in Great Neck, he came to my house, you know, to visit. And all of a sudden, you know, around the Sabbath table, you know, we're sitting together. And all of a sudden, the whole story came out. We were like stunned.
And did he feel better after telling
it? Yeah, for sure he felt. But the meaning, Memorial Day, you know, the Israeli Memorial Day for him has a completely different meaning. And I had friends in my unit, and they stayed after I left. Seven of those guys died in a bombing. Meaning, so everybody here knows it. So I think that you guys choosing the Israeli part of it, I think it's great. Also, there's usually a great bonding between America and Israel, usually. So I think that works for many in many many ways.
The idea of soldiers to travel with stay as connected as
100%.
So by the way, you know, you talk about almost everyone in Israel gets drafted. So one of the places that they go is Special in Uniform. You familiar with
Special in Uniform?
It's where the kids with autism.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal, for them. For the kids, it's phenomenal.
It's phenomenal. They get to feel that they're a part of society, part of the action, they actually exactly. being valued. I think it's great. But exactly. going back, to what you do, I think it's phenomenal. And I think this is, when you wrote to me, I figured this guy is not only a real estate guy. A lot of the people like to talk real estate, and that's great. And that's what my show is about. But right. when a person comes in and says, listen, I'm a real estate guy, but I have a passion, and the passion is my heart. And I want to talk about this because what we do is help people have a better life after they gave so much of themselves to us, to all of us, meaning we have a better life because of them. And we have freedom because of them. We owe it to them. So we have a mission to look into our hearts and to give our time for those people. And I think this is phenomenal.
I think the statistic in the States, I believe, is that less than 1% of Americans serve, as opposed to what goes on in Israel. But I also think that a lot of Americans don't necessarily take the time to appreciate goes on. You know, Memorial Day for us is a day off for a lot of people.
I know. For me, I'll tell you something. I lived in Israel, then I lived in America, and I lived back in Israel, I mean, both countries. And to me, I always used to say, Memorial Day, in my opinion, again, my humble opinion, shouldn't be a day of people saying, hey, happy Memorial Day. It's not a happy day.
That's true.
It's not a happy day. It's a day where people should have a parade. Great. But it's not a day for happiness. You want a day for happiness? That's Independence Day. The Memorial Day should be a day for reflecting, for connecting, for appreciating, for understanding that other people went and sacrificed their lives for you, to hear their stories, their sad stories, their tragic stories, and to tell the kids, look, these are people who made sure, who sacrificed their lives in order for everybody else to be able to live. So I think, meaning the right greeting for Memorial Day would have been have a meaningful Memorial Day and not have a happy Memorial Day.
100%. 100%.
Save the barbecue for 4th of July. Get some, meaning that, again, that's my opinion, but.
No, you're 100% right. Only because, like I said, most people don't give a second thought to these guys who make these sacrifices. And people are allowed to do whatever they want, but that's wrong. I think they deserve a lot more of our time, thought, and attention.
100%.
That's what we try and do.
I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to go get back to the real estate part, and I want to talk about, meaning that's a pretty radical shift, but since we do talk about real estate, I want to talk a little bit about the market today. You obviously know what the market is today. And right. I hear a lot of people saying, we are back since you lived through it as a professional. I guess the most profound way. What do you think about the market today? Where are we going with it?
You know, I that's a good question. So I have two daughters who live in Manhattan, and rental prices are higher than they were pre-pandemic, which is surprising, particularly given the fact that New York City is, the quality of life has definitely dropped a little bit. So that's surprising. I'm not sure if that's a question of landlords keeping inventory off the market because a lot of laws have changed. The 2019 law that limited to a fairly decent extent what a landlord could do to maximize his property's value. And multifamily, I think, is relatively in an okay place. I think that industrial has been on fire. Warehouse has been extremely strong. But when it comes to the office market, it's very difficult to know what that's going to end up looking like. This work at home has been an unbelievable circumstance for a lot of landlords. Vacancy rates are definitely elevated. Work at home has definitely taken over. I mean, I I got out of college undergrad in 1980. And you did whatever you needed to do, because that was a bad economy time, but you did whatever you needed to do to get a job, to pay your dues. And it's a much different environment now, where the, you know, a lot of the power has swung to the worker, who can now dictate, I don't want to go back to the office. I want to work remotely. And it's so hard to find employees that they can get away with that. So I'm not sure what the office market's going to look like. You know, I know there's a lot of talk that they're going to turn office buildings into affordable housing. You know, I don't know what that's going to look like. But I mean, I think overall, the commercial real estate market is in a decent place. You know, now that interest rates are going higher, cap rates are going to go higher, values are going to have to drop to some extent, depending on how high interest rates go. You know what? Honestly, in New York, to me, it's kind of like a work in progress. People pay big numbers to get out of New York, to Long Island, to Westchester. Yeah, it's a good question.
To Florida, to Texas, to the Sun Belt.
No doubt about it. I know a lot of people who are at least trying to establish residency in Florida, Texas, Nevada. Yeah, I mean, you know, New York in a lot of ways is its own worst enemy, whether it's through legislation or through taxation. It's not good, in my opinion.
Right. So, and yet, many of us love New York, but that's the way it is. But I agree with you about your analysis in terms of the office market. Obviously, you know, even the multifamily market, you know, everybody needs a roof over their head. At the same time, we see the cap rates going down and down and down. And, you know, eventually it has to go through some correction. So obviously, let's not talk collapse, meaning we're not in the 2008 problem. We're not in the mortgage, you know, issue. There's no, you can't even compare, but it's definitely getting to a peak. So,
you know, as a prior trader, we used to, because I actually taught trading, you know, I would say nothing goes up in a straight line, you know, whether it's a pullback to a new high or just a pullback, you know, nothing goes in a straight line. And we pretty much had a pretty good straight line up for the past year or so. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Accurate. We'll have to see. We'll have to see.
Yep.
Michael, I'll tell you what, it's a pleasure speaking to you. You are a man of so many things. You're involved in so many things, not only your business experience, but your, you know, philanthropic experience, your personality as a person who wants to give back. I think it's phenomenal. And I really,
thank you.
Really enjoy our conversation, really.
Could I change my background for one quick second?
Go ahead.
So this is...
I'll have to tell the people who are actually listening to podcast mode that we're seeing the background. And before, Michael had the background of his title company, okay? And right now he switched it to Heroes. What is that? Heroes2Heroes.org. So you guys are listening on the podcast medium. You can hear Heroes2Heroes.org. And you see a picture of a person in the Western Wall, a veteran.
That's cool.
Who's basically probably meditating or pouring his heart, et cetera. Yeah, go ahead.
No, that's right. That's right. So this is, you know, I use this picture a lot because I think it's very, powerful. You know, and where we say it's a non-denominational 501c3, this gives you a good idea that is in fact that it is, and that whether it's the Western Wall, Yad Vashem, the Jordan River, Church of the Sepulchre, you know, you are living right now in a very spirit, in probably the most spiritual place on earth.
That's right. That's for sure. We feel it. We know it. Sometimes when you live in a place, you know, sometimes you lose a little bit of it, but we definitely... you know, every time I drive by the walls in the old city of Jerusalem, all of a sudden, boom, you know, it hits you again that something is there. and you know, living around, I would say, you know, when you're in America, I'll compare it to America and Europe, for example. In America, you go through places that are sometimes 100, 200, 300 years old, and you get, wow, right? You feel like, wow, there's history here. There's a meaning here. And then you go to Europe and you go through places that are 500 and 1,000, you know, years old, etc. And, you know, rarely you go to places that are thousands, like the Colosseum and stuff like that. But then you come to Jerusalem and you bump into places that are thousands, thousands of years old. And it's in every corner. You feel history in the most profound way, and the spirituality is here for everyone in every religion. So absolutely, absolutely. And I hope our veterans will get the most out of it. And I hope you will be very successful with your business. It sounds like you've made quite a way. Michael, it was really a pleasure to having you here.
The pleasure was mine, and I very much thank you for the invitation.
100%. And you know what? You guys can see the links above and below. The title insurance, if you want to put back the, you know, the background, or tell us about, you know, your company, how they can, people can find you, whether it's LinkedIn or other ways. You guys can see the links, of course. Go ahead, Michael.
So you can find us. It's basically HallmarkAbstractLLC.com.
HallmarkAbstractLLC.com.
LLC. And we have a presence on LinkedIn. We have a presence on Facebook, Instagram. And, you know, anyone who wants to reach us, you know, please feel free, ask any questions, and we'd be happy to help.
100%. Michael, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You guys, I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you got a lot from it, because I did. And I'll see you in the next show. Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.